Have you ever considered Botox? Maybe you're already a devotee and you're considering the knife. Maybe just a little eyelid lift or a chin lift or a facelift. And what about your breasts? Are you happy with them? And is your stomach flabby and your love handles too wide? These are the thoughts that go through women's heads constantly. If this is you, stop now and listen to this interview with the biggest blogger in the UK about the psychological aspects of cosmetic and non-surgical procedures. She's a member of the British Association of Counselling and Psychotherapy. She's Deborah Sandler, and she is the co-founder of CosmeticSupport.com. Today, we're talking about her book, Thinking of Having a Procedure? Hi, Deborah. Welcome to Radio Gorgeous.
Oh, thank you for inviting me on to Radio Gorgeous.
So let's get this straight. Are you for or against cosmetic procedures?
I am on the side of the patient. Whatever they want. If they want a procedure, I'm happy to support. If they don't want a procedure, I'm happy to support. My role is to work out for the patient or allow the patient to find out what motivates her or him to make a decision in having a procedure.
Okay, so why do we need this book? Why do we need to ask these questions?
There's a couple of reasons why the book is important, actually. About a year and a half ago, Health Education England created new qualification recommendations for cosmetic practitioners. In it, they actually recommended some psychological support for patients. I was a member of the expert reference group, and we worked out, you know, how cosmetic practitioners could be better qualified. What do they really need to make them a good cosmetic practitioner? And part of that, of course, is patient safety. But with cosmetic procedures, it's physical, but it's also psychological in many, many cases. So I was able to, first of all, I was invited onto the expert reference group, and I was able to provide some of the psychological issues, which are now part of the recommendations. That's a lot to take on board.
Now, but have the practitioners taken this on board, or is it one of those laws that have just come in and they just think, let's grab the money and get the knife out?
That's a really good question. If you look at the description, it's qualification recommendations. There is a real lack of regulation. The industry believe that, so I'm talking about surgeons and doctors now, and nurses and others who practice, all believe that regulation surrounding fillers is the answer to patient safety. And whilst it would undoubtedly improve patient safety, it isn't the whole answer. There is still a psychological element, and that needs to be addressed not by a cosmetic practitioner, but by a counselor or a psychotherapist or somebody who can be neutral with the client or patient before and after, should anything go wrong, or even if things do go right, people still need someone to talk to that isn't part of the marketing mix.
Now, the thing is that, as you say, it's been recommended, but it would be an extra cost, it'd be an extra session, it'd be an extra... Also, maybe the sort of person looking for cosmetic surgery is looking for an answer on the outside because they don't want to look inward.
That's often true. But most people are intelligent enough to know that they're being motivated by something else. There's always a feeling that goes on with it. Some people are very clear. My nose is crooked, for example. I want to have my nose fixed, and there isn't anything for them to really consider psychologically. But sometimes at the end of that process and the nose is straight and they think, I should be happy now. In fact, I should be smiling, and everything that I thought was holding me back as a result of my nose is no longer holding me back, and yet I feel the same. And that is just not something that the cosmetic industry is able to help patients with. That is definitely something that counselors and psychotherapists are able to help with.
So this is a phenomenon then that people think, if I have something done on the outside, I'll change on the inside. But surely that's ridiculous if we look at it sort of from us two sitting here on the Radio Gorgeous sofa. We think that sounds ridiculous. But if you're the actual person, you kind of cling on to it, don't you?
Well, the marketing is made to make people feel that way.
Okay, so can you give us an example of marketing?
Perhaps. I haven't really looked at any in quite some time, but I know that for my time growing up, there were things like, you know, feel great on the beach with new breasts. What if you have new breasts and you don't feel great on the beach? That's possible, but it's almost as if that thought is not allowed to happen. You're not allowed to think, what if I don't feel great? And unfortunately, a lot of the practitioners think, well, if a client is asked to look at that thought, they might actually not want to have the surgery done. But in fact, it makes for a healthier client for them to go in fully prepared, knowing that there's a possibility that they might not feel any different afterwards.
Exactly. So do we have a mental problem if we want Botox? I'm being very upfront here.
No, I don't think we do. Botox is fortunately something that is reversible over time. It will wear off, and I don't think that we do. However, there is a psychological disorder called body dysmorphic disorder, which I'm sure all of the listeners have heard about. There's an awful lot of misinformation about it. And for those people who are seeking appearance change who have body dysmorphic disorder, they might not be happy with the results.
So how many people have body dysmorphia?
The figures are in my book, which unfortunately I can't quote.
I think it was something like one or two in 100.
I'm not sure if that was America or the UK, but it's higher than we think. And the majority of them do turn up for Botox and fillers more than they turn up for surgery.
Wow. So how would we know that we had body dysmorphia, or we had a friend or a mother, or how would we, what
we
are the symptoms?
You might not know. A lot of people think they have it because they're unhappy with their results, or they think they have it because they're just unhappy with their appearance before they go in for any surgery. But perseverating and being upset about a particular body type isn't necessarily just in itself an indication of body dysmorphic disorder. We can be unhappy about all sorts of things and yet not have a mental health disorder.
I have never met anyone, including top models, and I've met them, everybody has got a part of their body they don't like.
Absolutely. And that's the point. It's at what point does it stop becoming a kind of everyday type of thing?
So how would we know it was a problem? Could you give us an instance?
As I said, I don't necessarily think you would always know, but the people around you would. And it's for the people around you to sort of maybe sit down and talk to you if they can, but it's really, they're probably not going to be capable of doing that, because, you know, you're just going to be the annoying person that doesn't stop talking about your nose, chin, eyes, whatever it is, and your constant focus. In addition, it will affect the person's social life, so they will probably not be going out socially. And will,
because they're so aware of this thing that they think is terrible.
Yes, it's also known as imagined ugliness. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that can be so overwhelming, and it will be so overwhelming for a body dysmorphic disorder patient, that they will not go out socially. They will usually choose a partner that enables them to live this life, which is pretty much
private.
Yes, the two of them. And so, you know, you would probably need a consultation, which is why, again, you know, some sort of psychological pathway within the patient care program, certainly of surgery, and I think of non-surgical cosmetic procedures too, would help an awful lot of people to get clear in their mind whether or not they have an actual issue before they go in.
So let's talk about the book. So we're talking about I'll be upfront, I'm thinking of having an eye lift sometime. I'm 55 and I've just noticed it sags down. And I just think when I lift up my eyes, I think, God, I'd look so much younger, you know. And I've talked to a lot of people. I've talked to a friend of mine who came round who had it. She's given me the surgeon's name. And I looked him up and it was £4,000. And I thought, oh, gosh, that sounds a lot. How do you find a good surgeon?
Finding a good surgeon, the first thing to do would be to check the credentials of the surgeon. And it's amazing how many people go in for surgery without doing that.
Wow.
I've seen lots of patients post-surgically, and one of the top five questions I'll ask is, who did the surgery? And I'll be met with, oh, I can't remember his name. I'm not even sure if he still works in that clinic anymore. Wow. So the first thing that clients and patients need to understand is the qualifications, what they are. So they would be listed on the GMC specialist register for plastic surgery.
Okay, yeah, what else would they be?
And possibly they would be listed on the British Association of Aesthetic Plastic Surgeons list. So rather than go through the Fellow of the Royal College of Surgeons, FRCS PLAST, on the GMC website, you could just go straight to the BAPS website, which is the British Association of Aesthetic Plastic Surgeons, and you'll find the surgeons there listed. They will all be members of the specialist register for plastic surgery and listed on the GMC, and you can cross-check.
And are you charged for the first time you go and kind of meet these people and talk about what you like? I mean, if you are charged, is that a bad sign, or is it free to go in for a consultation? How does it work?
You're talking about consultations now, yeah, between a surgeon and a patient. Mm. Well, I don't think there's any kind of true rhyme or reason. Some charge, some don't. Some surgeons work inside clinics who will have a policy of charging or not charging, depending. Some surgeons work in private practice. They often charge, but some don't. There was some talk a while back of having an across-the-board policy, we either all do this or we either all do that.
I agree. Otherwise you'd think, well, they're charging, oh, that one's free, I might go to that, and that one's got a payment plan. You know, so many people are kind of motivated by money, really. You know, they think, look, I really want to have it done, but I'm you know, the expense. And also, sorry, I know I'm jumping the gun a bit, but what about, I've got a friend that went and had a tummy tuck in Turkey. What about going abroad?
Well, I think, you know, listening to some of the advertising that goes on in this country, you would think that it was a crime to go abroad for plastic surgery, that there can't possibly be good surgeons in other countries. But in fact, there are. The International Society of Aesthetic Plastic Surgeons lists, that's in my book as well, you'll find the full list of all the different countries, what to look for if you're in another country. And very often they are trained to the same standards, sometimes higher, sometimes lower. And of course, it's a risk that you have to take, but it's a risk that you can take in this country as well as any other country. And just because a surgeon is listed on the specialist register doesn't necessarily mean that he's the right surgeon for you. So the consultation process can be really pricey if you need to see three or four before you're happy.
Which you probably should do. You should go and see three. Yes. To find, you know, it's like if you were going to decorate your house, you'd have three people around, wouldn't
yes.
you, to give you quotes.
Yes, that's right. And I think the seriousness of plastic surgery is often lost in the way it's marketed and advertised. You know, it's just happy, smiling faces, and it's unrealistic models, and it just doesn't bear resemblance to the reality. The reality is that you probably will be happy. You probably will look better. The majority of patients do. Mm. But for those that don't, they're left cut adrift, basically. And even if they go to the British Association of Counselling and Psychotherapy to look for a counsellor, there isn't a listing there necessarily for cosmetic patients. And that's just one other topic that I'd really like to bring up if I can. And that is, we're talking about cosmetic patients. We're not talking about reconstructive aesthetic patients, because they do get an awful lot of support, both through the NHS and with their surgeries and, you know, with all everything that brings them to the point of needing reconstructive aesthetic surgery. A cosmetic patient is not looking to fix back to where it once was. They're looking for a change in appearance, an improvement in their appearance. And that language is a very specific language that is can be very difficult to communicate. First of all, the patient may have difficulties in saying exactly what they want.
True.
And a surgeon may not always be aware of his or her own limitations in providing that. So that consultation is a really important thing. And it's a shame that there are some great surgeons who are charging quite a lot of money, which does play into the decision. But even so, that doesn't necessarily mean that the surgeon is any better in eliciting the goals of the client or the patient in what they want. Sometimes things can only be done that can be done.
Yes. Yeah, realistic. Yeah. Because
well,
I imagine people go with a kind of, they want some complete, you know, they want to look as you, I mean, sorry, to quote you in the book, you say, it's possible to look 10 years younger, but no more than that, really.
Mm. I think that's true of facelifts, 10 to 15 years, possibly, if depending on your structure and your the quality of your skin. And we don't all age the same way. Mm. Everyone has different health conditions that can play into it. So, yes, I think people can look great after surgery, but that doesn't always mean they'll feel great. And that's the part that's missing in this patient pathway. There needs to be an overall holistic look at the patient. What does the patient really want? If, for example, a patient goes in and she's having difficulty describing how she wants her nose to look, how she wants her eyes to look, or how he wants his jaw to look, then, you know, a quick referral to somebody who specializes in this kind of language will do wonders in getting that articulation going, because there is little point in a surgeon going, yes, no, I understand, when in fact what he understands is from a completely different perspective than what the patient
he's looking
understands.
As a surgeon, and they're looking aesthetically. That's
yes,
the difference.
He's looking at it anatomically. Mm. What can he actually do with what's there?
Mm.
And they're looking at, well, you know,
the end result.
Yes. Mm. Yes. Mm. Yes.
And I suppose, tell us about the actual thing about having a facelift. I'm really curious. What's the procedure then? What happens?
I have never had one. Mm-hmm. Although in the book, as I've mentioned, I have been accused of having one.
That's a compliment.
I suppose in a strange way. I don't really know, because I haven't had one. I can tell you more about what motivates someone usually, and that is just generally the aging process. Mm. We're talking about cosmetic patients only, so again, making clear that we're not talking about reconstructive aesthetic patients who may have had an accident or an illness that has, you know. There are also, unfortunately, reconstructive aesthetic patients who've had bad surgery, so they fall into a gray area. They may have first started out as cosmetic patients, and now are they still cosmetic patients?
Because it's gone wrong.
Probably not. They're now at the point where they want reconstructive.
I know we sort of, it's a bit horrific to kind of dwell on the horror, but can you tell us a couple of kind of horror stories? I'm not trying to scare people, but obviously we are intrigued. That could be why we're listening to this podcast.
I have written some case histories within the book that I've done, and I think the most common kind of upsets after surgery are the nose and fillers. Those are the two most common presentations that I see or that I hear from.
Well, just think how personal your nose is. Your nose is, it's more personal than your face, because your nose is. And also, you've lived with that nose for so long and that shape, and then it comes out and they might have done something weird with a tip. I mean, remember Michael Jackson's? It was just a collapsing point. So tell us the sort of thing that they had that, you know, they didn't like.
Well, the problem is you can't hide your nose. You can't hide your face. Balaclavas are not trendy. So unfortunately, we have to really, really be very serious about the most important part of a surgery is finding the right surgeon. That's really it in a nutshell. and hoping that it all goes well on the day. For the majority of people, they do come out happy. So I'm not sitting here saying, don't go for surgery, you're never going to be happy. That's not what I'm saying at all. I think that you can be very happy if it's what you want and you found the right surgeon and you understand what the limitations of your expectations are and the surgeon is honest about the limitations of his skill.
So have surgeons ever used you? Have they, you know, got you in, Deborah?
I am completely independent, so no. I could easily earn a fortune by offering to be both a therapist and someone who can discuss...
Attached to a clinic.
Yes, yeah. But I have been an independent non-profit. I don't charge. I haven't charged. I set up cosmetic support in January 2000 with a clinical psychologist because we both felt that this was just absolutely crazy that people were going online for genuine conversation and we're being met with marketing people who only had good things to say. And it's not that we have bad things to say, it's just that
hold on, you're saying, what? Hold on, you've got to think before you leap.
Yeah, yeah. Look at the detail of the yeah. picture. Don't just go in and think that you've seen the picture by a quick glance.
What's the youngest person you've heard of having surgery?
I think the youngest people would probably fall into the reconstructive aesthetic group. So they might be people who are born with large ears. So pinoplasty is quite a big thing.
That's a big one for men especially. Yeah.
Cleft palate is another thing. But they fall into the category of...
Yeah, they've already got something that's quite awkward. Yeah.
Yes, they want something fixed. Mm. So I think, you know, 18 is usually a good age if you're going to have anything fixed.
Yeah, because then also you developed in your face, you know.
Yeah, pretty much.
I mean, my daughter went to school with a girl who was from, like, Arab states, and she did have a big nose. And what's really clever is they made it small, but the same shape. Mm-hmm. So she's kept the Arab shape, which actually is really clever, because it makes her still look Arab, as opposed to having this tiny little nose on a kind of... It wouldn't have suited her massive eyes, you know what
I
mean?
No, I think those days have gone when we used to see, you know, Farrah Fawcett Major and the ski slope nose. They've long gone, which is great. And surgeons are capable of great things. You know, it's just a matter of finding, putting the right patient with the right surgeon together. That's not my job. Mm. But my job is to make sure to find out that the patient is completely satisfied with what she has understood or he has understood in the consultation, because lots of men are having surgery now.
So your website's cosmeticsupport.com. Mm. What sort of calls do you get or emails?
Well, I have two websites. Mm. Cosmetic Support was set up in January 2000 and another one that I set up a few years ago. So that's called Cosmetic Surgery Counselling. And that's really more for surgical patients because I think they need much more in-depth counselling. But it's all short-term counselling, so it's maybe a couple of sessions before, a couple of sessions after. It's all negotiable. It's not like the old-fashioned idea of therapy where you're in there contemplating your navel for forever. It's nothing like that. Cosmetic Support is for the non-surgical, so they can call up. It doesn't even have to be a 50-minute hour. It could be
on the telephone or by Skype, can it?
Yeah, it's Skype, FaceTime, phone. Mm. Yeah. So it's convenient.
It doesn't take long, but you just go. Do you just explain all the things that are going to, you know, the sort of things that they might not be aware of? Is that the idea?
Yes, I run through, you know, what the GMC is, that's General Medical Council, what the lists are there, which list to look for, what FRCS and what the PLAST means, and, you know, how to find a list on the British Association of Aesthetic Plastic Surgeons. So all the general basic information, which a lot of people find really shocking to begin with, because it's not really something that's ever shown on the advertising. A lot of people say to me, well, why do I need to look at that? Why do you then? Because you need to make sure that whoever you're entrusting your face or body to is qualified to put that knife there.
Are the people out there who are unqualified doing this?
There are people who are less qualified than they ought to be. And the numbers are obviously very difficult to know. There was recently a program on television, I think it was on BBC or I don't know what station it was, where there was an undercover reporter who was sort of ferreting out all the people that were practicing illegally. For example, if you are a practitioner who's offering Botox, you do need to be able to work with a doctor who can provide the first consultation and the prescription to the actual practitioner. And that often does not go on. I mean, it's not illegal for anyone to provide, well, for, you know, therapists and nurses and doctors to do the filler without the prescription. That's perfectly fine. And that's why there's so much uproar in the industry. They really want that to become prescription only, like Botox. That might help.
Okay, so let's talk about Botox and fillers, because our listeners might be more, they might be using that more, because our kind of average age of a listener is 49 to 54. I must say I've had fillers and I've had Botox. I'm very, very happy with the results. And I like to think that I look very natural, because I go to this very good woman in Notting Hill Gate. But I was, we're doing a podcast about Nigella Lawson, and I did Nigella latest photographs, and I could not believe her face is a mask. I mean, it's just not a, her face literally, it looks kind of very bloated, and it doesn't look like it moves. You know, that's not the look we should be going for, is it?
I think it really depends on what you want from your look. She's a woman who's frequently on television. And I think how we appear on the screen can be different. I would agree that on a day-to-day level, if you're interacting with, you know, your friends and family, that might not be a great look. But if she is happy with it, that's what's important.
But don't you think people don't know how far they've gone? Because they're sucked into this thing. I mean, a lot of my friends have said, I'm really scared of having even Botox or surgery, they're scared of everything, because they say, once I start, how will I know when to stop?
Well, I think if you start gradually and you like what you have seen, then, you know, yes, I mean, it's very easy. I have Botox. I haven't had fillers, but I do have Botox. And I can see how easy it is to start saying, well, just a little bit more here, a little bit more there. But a good practitioner is going to say to you, no, that's not going to work. It's just not going to work. Some practitioners, this is what I mean about finding the right practitioner. Some practitioners like that frozen appearance themselves and want to give it, and so wind up having a clientele who like that. And others like a very natural look, and that you can still furrow your brow, you can still crinkle your eyes, you can still do all of that kind of stuff, but still look a little bit more refreshed than you might do without it. And they build up their clientele. And people just seem to find the practitioner that's right for them. But I think to go into it worrying about what might happen in the future sort of ruins the fun of just having a little bit of something done, if that's what you want to have done.
Exactly. Well, I must say, I am now, I'm still considering the eyelids. A lot of people, are very scared of having, you know, cosmetics and procedures and everything. Are they the sort of people, and then also that they are the people with the, you know, oh, I don't like this, I hate that part of my body, I hate my stomach, and they might be kind of, are they sort of people that would never be happy? Are there people out there who might never be happy with what they've had done?
That's a really interesting question, because going back to body dysmorphic disorder, you know, they are unlikely to ever be happy with anything that gets done. Also, it can be difficult for a surgeon to even know what that patient might want done, because remember, it's also called imagined ugliness, so it's not always clear what it is they're actually...
So what might they go in and say what they want?
It could be absolutely anything, but the most common parts are the face, the nose, the eyes, the face, the tummy. So they're no different than anyone else in that respect. They are unlikely to ever come away and say that they're happy. But equally, there are people without mental health issues who also would not be happy. And that's where things get difficult, because they don't have anyone to talk to. Going back to complain, you know, through the recommendations that I talked about in the beginning, there should be a clear complaint pathway. How often that works in reality, I don't know. I mean, I do know that one particular patient who went in to complain about her results, that was a surgeon who was using my services, who had my leaflets on his table, and still never made the referral to her, even though she actually said, you know, I need to speak to somebody. I'm going mad. This is crazy. And so she eventually found me just through Twitter and searching online for this kind of service. But, you know, there are always going to be people who are just not going to be happy. And the mental health provider, the counselor, the psychotherapist, they're there to ascertain, are they not happy because they have a mental health disorder which is stopping them from ever becoming happy with their result? Or are they unhappy because there really is something here that can be done differently if there was a redo involved or something like that?
Do some people keep going because they can't get it, they think they can't get it right?
That's right, yes, they do. Because they have failed to have that conversation where they fail to have found someone to have a conversation with where they can understand what acceptance is. And I'm not saying everyone should go for acceptance, because there are always going to be botched surgeries where
Also, top surgeries can go wrong. You quoted the American comedian who had a fatal heart attack. We do know that any procedure, I mean, you know, my mother was having a procedure in her 70s. She had to give up smoking. You know, going under the knife at any point, even, you know, to have a bunion done or something is dangerous, isn't it?
Yes, it's all risk. I mean, you're taking a risk whenever you go under. But I mean, you know, things are very safe these days and the fatality rate for that kind of thing is low. So the chances of you being allowed to have a general anaesthetic for several hours during a facelift without a proper health
monitor
is unlikely. And that's another reason why it's important to choose a surgeon who's qualified to make these kind of assessments, to say to you, right, we need to check and see what your medical history is, what your blood pressure is like, what your, you know, cholesterol is like, what your heart is like, and what your previous illnesses are. So,
because yes, I bet for some people don't even take that consideration.
Well, they don't. They don't. They worry about it. They worry, oh my God, I'm going, what about, what will happen? Who's going to, you know, what, my kids, my husband, this and that and the other. But they don't stop to think, could I make this slightly safer for myself somehow, some way? But again, a lot of that is down to, you know, finances, and that, you know, often the less qualified surgeon is slightly cheaper, offering some sort of package deal and things like that. I mean, you know, there's been a lot of recommendations have gone through to say no more of these Groupon deals, like, you know.
Well, Groupon deals for plastic surgery.
Yes, Groupon for Botox.
Yeah.
And Groupon, oh, I see. And Groupon for surgery as well.
Yeah. But Groupon for Botox is bad again because it's sucking in women in their only 20s having.
Well, I think that's the word, vulnerability. Mm. That's the point. And that is my biggest complaint about this whole thing, is that the preying on the vulnerability of women to constantly look young, to constantly look fresh. I mean, we are all susceptible to that. We all want to look like we did, you know, 10 years ago. So the marketing plays to that, and it makes all of us vulnerable.
Thank you so much for coming on to Radio Gorgeous, Deborah, today.
Thank you.
So Thinking of a Cosmetic Procedure, Psychological Issues and the Search for Better Safety by Deborah Sadovitz-Sandler is published by Weather Eye. And can you just tell us the name of your websites again for people that want to contact you immediately?
www.cosmeticsupport.com.
Lovely. Thanks so much for coming on to Radio Gorgeous and sharing your fantastic view, which we all need to think about plastic surgery before we rush ahead and have it. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
And for even more amazing women, always tune in to radiogorgeous.com, darling.